The snow could be heavy at times, a high around 41. For tomorrow night, more snow, total accumulation between 2 and 6 inches, a low tomorrow night around 30. Then for Sunday, the melt-off starts with sunny skies and warmer temperatures. Tomorrow's make that Sunday's high around 46. Right now we've got sunshine and 50. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget, Jack's Cafe. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am really privileged to be speaking once again on the Morning Show with a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage, Dr. Gerald Mast, who is Associate Professor of Political Science. And we've had Professor Mast on the Morning Show any number of times. I'm especially grateful to have this opportunity to talk with him about one of the most important issues that confronts the human race, actually, and everybody who inhabits this planet, namely the specter of climate change. And we're going to be talking about this in a couple of different ways, but in particular, from sort of a political perspective. That is, how are we, as, for instance, a voting public here in the United States, confronting or failing to confront this issue of climate change? And how are our political leaders dealing with it? And what sorts of, in a sense, political cost are they weighing in assessing how they are going to confront this issue and speak about it and stake their own political claims around it? And of course, that is an especially dicey situation, perhaps, when it comes to the crowded field of Democratic contenders for president in this 2020 election that is looming on the horizon. And how are some of these Democrats thinking about this, talking about it, framing this issue? And since so many of them, at least, pretty much share a common concern over climate change, how do given candidates distinguish themselves in this crowded field, specifically around this crucial issue? So we have all kinds of things to talk about, and I can't think of anybody better to engage in this conversation than Professor Mast, who has cared deeply about this issue for quite a long time. And you have also recently released a book called Climate Change, Politics and Policy in America, Historical Documents and Context, which touches on a whole lot of this. So, Professor Mast, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
Thanks so much, Greg. It's, as always, a pleasure to be here.
I wish we had a more pleasant topic that we were talking about, actually. I mean, this is, of course, as big a topic as there is, really, at least in the minds of many people, certainly not in the minds of all. And maybe that's one of the things that we should talk about right off the bat is maybe you could give us some sense, first of all, of where the American public is when it comes to this thing called climate change. What kind of numbers are we seeing in terms of people who have a concern about this versus those who are skeptical about this? And can we split the American public in a clean binary when it comes to this issue?
If I could, I'm going to preface discussion of public opinion where it is right now with maybe a little bit of history of the issue. And so when I was writing my book, one of the things that really struck me as important and I learned a fair bit about it as I was writing it, is that climate change as an issue has evolved in some kind of interesting ways. I would say that climate change is a scientific issue, right? But it's been a scientific issue for a lot longer than it's been a political issue. And so what we have to try to understand where we're at right now is we need to kind of understand the evolution of climate change as a scientific issue and then its emergence at the same time as a political issue. As a scientific issue, this is not a new subject. We can go all the way back to the 1820s. The French mathematician and physicist Joseph Fourier theorized about the greenhouse effect that long ago.
Wow.
Asking himself, why is the Earth more warm than the moon, for instance, right? And he said that it has to be the atmosphere trapping some of the heat near the surface, preventing solar radiation from re-radiating outward into space. In the 1850s, John Tyndall, physicist and engineer, demonstrated that in a laboratory setting, proved that gases, water vapor, carbon dioxide, methane, all absorb a certain spectrum of radiation and retain heat. That's the mechanism. So the basic physics of what we're talking about is pretty darn old. In the 1890s, Swedish chemist by the name of Svante Arrhenius took the physics and said, what would happen if we doubled the CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere? How much heat would we get on the planet? And he sat down that long ago and calculated it and published it in a journal. And incidentally, without access to sophisticated instrumentation and computers, he got pretty close. So he was a pretty smart fellow. He did win the Nobel Prize in chemistry, not for that, but pretty impressive feat of scientific thinking. In the 1930s, an engineer by the name of Guy Callender said, okay, so Arrhenius has worked out, you know, theoretically, what would we get? We've been pumping out CO2 from industrialization, right? Is the planet actually warming? And so he, with a much, much, much more incomplete kind of data record, began the process of kind of calculating it, and based on his projections, he said, yeah, the planet is actually warming since the pre-industrial times. And he published this paper and presented it to the Royal Society in London, over 80 years ago. In the middle of the 20th century, one of the more important public scientists in American history is a guy by the name of Roger Revelle, became the director of the Scripps Oceanographic Institute in California. He and his colleague Hans Suess did some radiocarbon dating of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And they found that the concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere it's very, very old carbon dioxide. Now, what does that mean? It means that this isn't carbon dioxide that's recently been released from forest fires or other kinds of natural sources. This is carbon dioxide that's been released from coal and oil, where the carbon dating clearly shows this is ancient carbon.
It has its own sort of footprint.
It has its own radioactive footprint, and so the increase in CO2 that we're seeing is human generated, right? It's human activity. Industrialization is the result of it. So this leads Seuss and Revel to say, well, we are in the midst of a grand experiment on a planetary scale. This is in the early 1950s. And so Revel hires a fellow by the name of Charles Keeling to actually let's measure CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere and track them over time. And so Keeling begins the process of collecting data in a very systematic way on Hawaii in a number of remote laboratories that the Scripps sets up. And that results in the famous Keeling curve. Everybody probably has seen this, right? The up and down movement of CO2 in the atmosphere. Up and down because in the winters, deciduous trees drop their leaves and they stop absorbing carbon. But then in summer, they grow back. And so what we end up with is this inexorably rising curve of CO2. In the 60s and 70s, we get increasing sophisticated computers. And so scientists are beginning to say, hey, let's start modeling the climate. So they're starting to build climate models. And all of this is generating research that authoritative scientific bodies with responsibility for kind of judging kind of the state of science in particular kinds of areas, like the National Academy of Sciences, are starting to look at this and issue reports. So by the end of the 1970s, the early 1980s, science understands pretty clearly that increased levels of CO2 are trapping heat in the atmosphere, that the planet is, in fact, warming. It's not easy to calculate a global average temperature, right? So, I mean, you have to take all of these temperature readings from all around the surface and then try to aggregate that into a total global average, and that's a challenge. In the 80s, you had a couple of efforts in that regard. NASA's Goddard Institute began the process of trying to calculate it. The climate research unit at University of East Anglia in the UK did the same thing. And their projections were right in line with each other, and they showed clearly that the planet is warming. And so the science is really clear on a few things. It's very, very clear on the role of CO2 and methane in the atmosphere, increasing the temperature of the planet. It's very, very clear that this is – these greenhouse gases, a good chunk of them are human created. And so as the issue, as a scientific issue, became increasingly sophisticated, increasingly clear on some kind of key issues, the implications became increasingly relevant, right? Well, what does this mean in a human kind of context? And that the implications are significant. It's hard to come up with an issue for which there are more significant implications. This is one of the most momentous, consequential kinds of issues for social systems, for civilization, and for everybody. For everybody, right. And so as those implications became increasingly clear, the size of them, right, they became political in the sense that the responses of human systems, right, to take this into account are going to involve costs and benefits. Who's going to gain those benefits? Who's going to pay those costs and so forth? And that triggered, right, a kind of effort on the part of certain kinds of interests to one, minimize the degree of certainty, right, that people perceive this science with, right, to amplify the doubt, to push what are, at this point, discredited alternative theories and so forth in order to prevent people from getting behind this. And so what we see is initially not a completely bipartisan agreement, but a somewhat bipartisan agreement that, oh, this is an issue, we should care about it, we should work on it. And it's gradually kind of becoming increasingly a partisan one. But as the stakes have gotten really more and more important, as the concern, the justified concern, has reached really high levels, we're beginning to see people on the Republican side kind of breaking ranks with a position of skepticism. And there's this kind of internal tension within the Republican Party over it. The Democratic Party at this point, in the last, I would say, decade to a decade and a half, has increasingly become kind of united around it. The Republican Party is divided and conflicted on this. So when it comes to the public opinion, right, it plays out in the following way. You have high levels of belief that climate change is happening, that it is a problem, and that we should do about it on the Democratic side. We're talking 90% of people who identify as Democrats saying these kinds of things. On the Republican side, it's much more mixed. So you have something on the order of you know, as far back as, say, 10 years ago, a third of Republicans to a quarter of Republicans would say, yeah, a climate change is happening. The science is there, right? So 1 in 3, 1 in 4, somewhere in there. To now, it's in the ballpark of around a half saying, yeah, it's happening and you know, there's some things we should probably be doing about it. But there's different levels at which you perceive and accept that the science is happening. It's one thing to say, I think climate change is happening, but I think it's largely about natural forces. So that's one way of kind of hedging your bets, which, by the way, the science really is clear. It's not a largely natural kind of thing. You build these models to replicate the past to see how accurate your model is, right? Mm. Can my model explain what we know happened in the last century? And no model that doesn't account for those human forces comes close to explaining what we've seen. So we know humans are behind us at this point. And so the opinion is kind of conflicted. When you move up the food chain, so to speak, within the parties, right? There, I mean, there's much less support for climate change amongst Republican office holders. Republicans in Washington, D.C. in particular, have been very opposed to, one, acknowledging that climate change is real and thus doing something significant about it. Now, there's some exceptions that are important, and we should probably talk about them at some point. But for the most part, Washington Republicans have been opposed to this. It becomes a little bit different when you get down to the state level. We can find examples of Republicans who have been what I would argue is kind of a responsible citizen on this, accepting the science, putting forth really good faith effort to do something about it. Governors like John Lynch in New Hampshire, George Pataki in New York, kind of key architects of the what's called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. It's a carbon market in the Northeast part of the United States. Arnold Schwarzenegger, another Republican governor, committed to trying to do something about climate change. So at the state level, it's a little bit more mixed. At the national level, not so much.
Mm. One of the things that we talked about before we went on the air is the business of persuasion and how persuasion is maybe a little bit of art, a little bit of science, a little bit of guesswork in terms of how people can be moved on right. This, can be moved off of their own position into another one. And you were saying that that's almost a cottage industry in and of itself, people studying
climate communication.
Right, and how to talk about this. And how to talk about it in a way that is true to the facts without engaging in too much speculation that's not tightly bound to the science, right. and also the matter of to what extent is it productive or counterproductive right. to frighten people to the core of their being. At some point, does that paralyze people from action or have them throwing up their hands in despair and giving up? There's a lot to untie there, but are those matters that are happening at the highest levels, or is that kind of down the so-called food chain?
I think they're happening all over, right, throughout. And especially for people who are really kind of concerned about the issue and engaged in it, right? So scholars, politicians who are trying to – how do I talk about this? How do I frame this? I said earlier, right, that some things about climate science are very clear, right, that the planet is, in fact, warming, that human activity is largely responsible for it. Where we begin to dwell into certain areas of uncertainty are, well, what is going to happen? Like, what does the future hold, right? And so we know that carbon dioxide and methane are absorptive gases, thermal insulating gases in the atmosphere. what is the particular sensitivity of the climate to their presence in the atmosphere? There's a little uncertainty around that. What that means in practice is if we increased CO2 this much, how much warming are we really going to get, right? And so we don't know for sure. And so when you look at the organizations that have taken responsibility for kind of trying to organize the science, organize the science and characterize it and communicate it to people, they talk about a range of a particular kind of what they call it concentrated pathways. If we don't do anything, what is likely to happen by the end of the century? Well, we'll get somewhere on the order of 3 to 6 degrees Celsius of increase. That fluctuation just is a level of uncertainty we don't know for sure. And that, how confident are we that it's going to fall within 3 to 6? We're very confident, but not completely confident. What does not completely confident mean? Well, it means that, you know, if you think about it as a bell-shaped curve distribution, right? The 3 to 5 degrees of warming is in the middle. That's the most probable outcome. But there's tail end distributions there, right? So it's possible that it's much less than 3 degrees. Maybe what we get is some kind of the triggering of feedback mechanisms that we didn't think about, right? That we didn't anticipate. And that kind of minimizes how hot the climate gets given a certain amount of emissions. But for, you know, the possibility of a happy outcome, there's the possibility of an even worse outcome than what we're talking about, right? And so on the other side of the tail end distribution is a future that's hotter than a 5 or 6 degree centigrade increase, if provided we don't do anything. And so, you know, when we're talking about what's likely to happen, there's always some degree of uncertainty. And that uncertainty is driven by things that we just simply don't quite know yet about the climate system, but also uncertainty about how human beings are going to respond, right? We don't know how the next election is going to turn out, so we don't know how the federal government is going to promote certain kinds of policies designed to move us away from fossil fuels. And that will have a big difference. So, you know, it's not clear what the future holds. And so when we talk about, well, what are we looking at down the road, the honest answer is we don't know for sure. But all we can do is talk about the possibilities, right? And do we emphasize the most dangerous case scenarios? Or do we talk about the hopeful, let's hope that things aren't as bad as you know, we expect them to be? And how different people encounter those messages, you know, it's going to vary. And it's not clear exactly what is the appropriate way to talk about it.
Right. And, of course, we're talking about complicated scientific matters. I mean, actually, there's probably certain core matters that are not all that complicated and then others that are quite complicated. And then I think on top of it is here we are talking about a planet that is warming. I mean, it's undeniable. In the last 30 years, I think the 20 hottest years ever have all been recorded within the last 30 years. I mean,
yeah.
There's all kinds of numbers
Correct.
You can look at Right. that are impossible to deny. On the other hand, this weekend, it's going to snow.
Right.
And so when people just kind of look around them at what's going on around them in their little neck of the woods, it isn't as though there aren't these certain signs that can confuse even the most well-meaning person about
right.
exactly what's going
right.
on.
It used to be once upon a time that if you didn't want to get into an argument with somebody, you picked a safe topic of conversation, and one of those safe topics was the weather. But no longer, right? No longer. Because the weather has, in some sense, become politicized, and people look for signs of a kind of worldview, signs that affirm a particular kind of worldview, an expectation of what happens. And this idea about what should the proper and moral and necessary relationship between human beings and nature be is implicated by these meteorological events.
Yeah. One thing I want to make sure we spend at least a minute or two talking about is the fact that up until now, in some ways at least, our discussion has been pretty much limited to the United States. And I've asked you about the American public and how do they
right.
fall on this. And of course, one of the most interesting things around this whole issue of climate change is that the United States is lagging far behind other parts of the planet that have been much more aggressive in confronting some of these issues. I wonder if you could just say a word about why that has been the case in your estimation, and to what extent that bodes for the future in a positive way.
Right.
Even if we are lagging, much of the planet is at the forefront of confronting climate change.
Right. So there have been systematic studies of the parties, major political parties in countries around the world, and their positions on climate change. And the Republican Party of the United States is the only party, major party, that as an official position has denied climate change in recent years. Now, again, as I said earlier, there are exceptions. So we can identify kind of key people in the Republican Party who are pushing back and trying to get their party, the Republican Party, to adopt a more responsible position on this. But to this point, the Republican Party has been officially, as a matter of official policy in the party platforms, so to speak, in denial on this. Conservative parties in Germany have accepted it. The Conservative Party in the UK has accepted it. Conservative Party in France has accepted it. Conservatives in Japan have accepted it. Now, they have differences of opinion over, like, exactly how big a problem is it, right? They have differences of opinion of, well, what should we do about it, given that it has happened? But the Republican Party is the one that has been stood out and unique in its denial. I would argue that the Conservative Party in Australia has kind of moved in our direction in that regards. So they too have been on this position of kind of climate science denial, one of the offenders. Why is that? So your question about why are we in some sense unique? I would argue that there's two kind of key factors there. One is that the United States is a big producer of fossil fuels. Fossil fuels have been very important part of our economy. And so there is a material interest in undermining the science or denying the issue or downplaying the implications associated with the science. So there's a material interest there. The United States is also culturally, right, more conservative than a number of other places. Conservative in the sense that it is committed to, and this is where terminology gets confusing, a classical liberal perspective on things. That is to say, we favor more free markets, smaller government, and so forth, right? We're more individualistic in terms of our political culture than a place like Sweden is, or a place like France is, or Spain is. And so where a place like Norway or Sweden is more inclined and naturally kind of open to the idea that there are these collective interests, individuals should kind of sacrifice certain kinds of things in order for the greater good and so forth, it's harder to make that pitch here in the United States.
Right. You're asking somebody to give up their Hummer, for instance.
And, exactly. Or at least pay more at the pump for it, right?
Right.
Filling it up.
Right. And so we, generally speaking, as Americans, and I'm one of them, bridle at anything that impedes our own standard of living and the way that we have lived our lives and so on, and the inconvenience that almost certainly would be part of yielding to some kind of edict from on high that would call us to really live our lives in a very different way. That's quite un-American
indeed.
In a sense.
No, you're right.
Interesting. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Gerald Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science at Carthage College, and we have been wrestling with the issue of climate change. So as we approach the 2020 presidential race, we have on the one hand, of course, an incumbent president who is very much on the record as a skeptic of climate change, and then we have this crowded field of Democrats, and it's shaping up for climate change to be an issue of paramount importance when it comes to those who identify as Democrats. You gave us a number of something like 90% who feel it to be an extremely serious matter. So
That probably overstates it. 90% don't think it's an extremely serious matter. 90% say it's a problem, it exists, it's real. Support within Democrats for kind of characterizing it in that way is probably much smaller.
I see.
Sorry.
Thank you for clarifying that. So anyway, on the Democratic side, then, there are an array of possibilities, including something we should talk about briefly called the Green New Deal. And I was surprised to learn as I kind of studied this that that terminology has actually been around for about a decade or so.
Right.
But it is more recent that that term has been bundled with a very specific array of legislative resolutions.
Right.
Just say a quick word about the Green New Deal and how it generally has been received thus far.
So the Green New Deal is a resolution that begins by affirming kind of the state of the science, looking at bodies like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, their more recent pronouncements, looking at the National Climate Assessment that the federal government puts out, the scientists and the government established, and says essentially that, you know, here's the case. Climate change is happening. It's very serious. Big problems are coming down the pike unless we commit to a kind of economic development that will lower greenhouse gas emissions by something like 40% to 60% by 2030 and achieve net neutral carbon emissions by the middle of the 21st century, of 2050. So that's it starts that with a kind of a statement of the science. It then transitions to economics, and it lays out a bunch of economic statistics that characterizes the economy as one that's very imbalanced and unfair, one in which the vast majority of increased income and increased wealth has been captured by very few people at the top, and working class incomes have stagnated, right? Debt has risen. So it's characterizing the science on the climate side, and then it characterizes the economics, and then it lays out what it claims is a vision for the country that would address both, right? It's going to lay out a rebuilding of infrastructure and a reconstitution of our energy system predicated on clean energy and increased presence of mass transit, new and improved infrastructure, a refurbishment of the nation's buildings and so forth, that is designed to decarbonize the economy and raise up the living standards for the vast majority of income earners in the country.
A tall order.
Right. So there are those who talk about like the Marshall Plan, right? So the Marshall Plan was the policies that the United States initiated in Western Europe in the wake of World War II to rebuild the economies and the infrastructure of Germany and France and Japan and so forth, right? And they did it in a relatively quick amount of time by harnessing energy and effort and money of multiple nations to get this done. And way back in the early 90s, a guy by the name of Al Gore wrote a book called Earth in Balance, and he says we need a Marshall Plan for modern societies to make them ecologically modern, right? To address and avoid catastrophic climate change. And so that is in some sense what the Green New Deal is, right? So the original New Deal, right, back in the 1930s was an attempt to kind of reconstitute the relationship between government and society and the economy by creating a safety net, by creating a set of regulations to avoid certain kinds of economic outcomes that from a societal perspective are harmful. The Green New Deal is a parallel to that. I mean, we should think of it as nothing less than a reconfiguration of the relationship between government and society and so forth, not to address kind of the Great Depression, but to address an unjust economic set of circumstances and make them just and ecologically sustainable.
Right. And one can well imagine how a typical progressive would greet such possibilities with great enthusiasm. And on the other hand, there are other people who would have the gravest concerns that this is a proposal that, in a sense, wipes out the United States that I might know and love and replace it with some other kind of state that one might not recognize.
Right. I mean, lots of people voted for Herbert Hoover.
Hmm. Right.
the original New Deal was controversial.
Absolutely. Let's talk about this crowded field of Democratic contenders for president And first of all, it would be interesting to just kind of hear from you if you are surprised that nearly 20 different people have come forward to placing themselves as potential nominees for president, if you are surprised that it is this crowded a field, given our recent political history. And then we'll take a moment or two to talk about also right. how these candidates are kind of shaping their response to this issue of right. climate change.
I would say yes and no. Am I surprised? I expected a big field. President Trump is fairly exceptional figure in American political history at this point, wildly unpopular on the Democratic side, notably unpopular amongst moderates. And so given the controversies around the Trump administration, I expected a pretty big field. I didn't have a number in my mind, but 20 seems pretty big, even given the circumstances. So there's that. With respect to how you know they're orienting themselves towards the issue, I would say that overwhelming kind of consensus amongst the Democratic field is that climate change needs to be a prominent component of the discussion about what it is that we're going to do if we're going to do something with respect to climate, and so. Especially if you compare it to 2016, climate didn't factor significantly in the debates, didn't factor significantly in the campaigns.
It's funny.
That's unlikely to happen again.
And I really hadn't stopped to think about that, but you're absolutely right. It's really kind of amazing how minor a presence that was in any of those debates.
Right.
It's remarkable.
Yeah, I remember sitting at the end of a debate, thinking of being appalled. Going, where was where were the questions about climate change?
Right.
I don't think that happens again. Right. I mean, I think that is going to be a factor. And yeah, just as an illustration of this, right? One of the candidates is Jay Inslee, governor of Washington, former member of Congress, has been governor of Washington for a while now. He has made climate change the centerpiece of his campaign. He said, if I were to become president, it would be the most high priority that my administration has. It's the biggest problem that the world faces. And I think that he did this thinking he would be able to distinguish himself from the field. And he's really struggled to distinguish himself from the field in many ways because all the other candidates have acknowledged that this is a real big problem and we've got to move forward. All of them, for instance, have said we need to return to the Paris Agreement that the world has, except for us, acknowledged. And we need to move past the Paris Agreement. We need to get to it and then we need to strengthen it because you had said, asked me a few moments ago about characterizing the state of the world aside from us. And I gave this kind of impression that the rest of the world is doing better than we are with respect to agreeing to this. And I would say that that's true, but the rest of the world isn't doing what it needs to do according to the science, right? So, I mean, the Paris Agreement says let's get some pledges in order to limit warming to 2 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. That's twice as much warming as we already have. 2 degrees of increase above pre-industrial warming would say essentially we're going to try to limit warming at twice the amount of warming that we already have at this point. Mm. And so most observers, all observers who are serious about this say 2 degrees is not a safe level of warming.
We need to do better than
that. We need to do better than that. And all of the pledges that the countries of the world have kind of agreed, well, again, now accepting us, have agreed to try to reduce their emissions by won't even get us to 2 degrees, right? Moreover, the countries aren't getting on target or on track with meeting their pledges, which are by themselves, insufficient in the first place. So the world absolutely – the United States needs to come back to the Paris Agreement, and the rest of the world needs to strengthen our commitments beyond what has been already committed in the Paris Agreement. So all of the Democratic candidates in the field now have at least said as much as that.
Right. And just to speak globally again for a moment, one of the factors that's difficult here is that we're not just talking about superpowers like the United States and China and so on, but we're also talking about a third world that is just awakening to a lot of possibilities that we've had with us for a long, long time. And in a sense, we have to wrestle with what we ask those nations in a very, very different place
right.
to do.
So, I mean, climate change is obviously a scientific issue. It's a scientific phenomenon. It's a political issue, but it's also a moral issue. And so you have a very uneven distribution of vulnerability and threat. All of the world is going to have to, on some level, adapt because a certain amount of change is going to happen regardless of what we do. And not everybody around the world is equally capable of adapting, right?
Right.
And the negative impacts are going to be worse in certain kinds of areas, right? The equatorial latitudes around the Earth are in much more danger than mid-continent latitude countries in the northern hemisphere. And so there's this distribution of vulnerability, right, that is in some sense the inverse of the distribution of responsibility. The wealthier mm-hmm. countries are more responsible for this problem. They're more cut out to adapt and face less danger than
right.
this issue of climate change asks us, what are our responsibilities as human beings, right? Humanity is now kind of in this set of circumstances, and we are, you know, thrust into this situation in which we must ask ourselves, you know, to what extent are we our brother's keepers?
Wow. It poses enormous questions, doesn't it? Fundamental questions, and how the United States is going to act upon some of these really difficult questions. A lot is riding on this election coming up in 2020. On the Democratic side, in this crowded field, of course, one of the things that most Democrats are thinking a lot about is which candidate has the best chance of defeating the incumbent president, Donald Trump,
right.
in 2020. As that question is weighed, what would you have people think about? What are sort of the factors that make that actually a complicated proposition?
Right. well, I guess I'll say this. I, as a scholar of policy, I think policy positions are important. We really ought to be thinking about the policy positions that candidates take and considering the relative strengths and weaknesses of those policy positions. We should be thinking about the character and kind of personal qualities that people have and with those characteristics make them fit to be a good leader. But as a political scientist, I'm kind of aware that many people make a judgment about who to vote for or who not to vote for based on more personal kinds of reactions that they have, more emotional kinds of reactions. They like this person. They don't like that person that much. Something turns them off about that person. And so I guess I would encourage all citizens to try to step away from their emotional reactions on a personal level to the candidates and think about you know, what it is that they're saying, and think about what it is that you think that the country needs to do moving forward. What do you think the country kind of requires in terms of somebody who's capable of communicating to people who, in a time of significant polarization, is going to be able to kind of speak to as wide a swath of our fellow Americans as possible? I hesitate to try to be more specific than that.
Sure. I wonder if you are surprised by any of the Democratic contenders at this point that have maybe shown more strength than you would have anticipated to be possible. I'm thinking, for instance, of a certain mayor from a relatively small Midwestern city.
Yeah, he would be at the top of my list in terms of kind of surprises.
Peter Buttigieg.
This is Peter Buttigieg, yeah. And, you know, I guess when you step back and think a little bit about it, it makes a certain amount of sense that he's one, because I think he's in a very impressive young man in terms of his stage presence, so to speak. He's
and resume.
And, well, yes and no, right?
Right. I mean,
he's impressive in terms of his his calmness, his confidence, and the manner in which he responds to certain kinds of questions. That in itself is impressive. It's impressive that, you know, as the mayor of a mid-sized city, he's now stormed onto the biggest stage in American politics and is being taken credibly. That's unique. His age is also makes him unique, right? So that's surprising. But the largest generation in the electorate are millennials at this point. And so my point earlier about people kind of identifying with a candidate on a personal and emotional level, it kind of explains, I think, some of Buttigieg's appeal, right? This idea that, he's 37 years old. I wish I were 37. But hypothetically speaking, if I'm a 37-year-old voter out there, I see somebody who has been in the world the same amount of time as I have, whose political socialization is in some sense reacting to the same events that I did, right? And so you feel like, that guy is going to understand me.
Interesting. And of course, it's actually in some respects a wide-ranging field and some really intriguing folks. And it was interesting to see as the process goes on who rises to the top, who sinks to the bottom, and just what kind of a political fray we find ourselves in with these candidates.
Well, it's early too, right?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Very early to be talking in such specifics. And of course, then you have an incumbent president, Donald Trump. And in a sense, because the core of his core seems to be so solidly behind him, is it a matter of Donald Trump's is the best thing he can do, just hang in there, hang tough, and not, in a sense, change any recipes at this point in time?
It's, I think, enormously hard to make predictions when it comes to Mr. Trump. I feel, in some sense, not qualified. If I can tie it back to climate change, real quick, yeah. I will say that the people who have stepped up to criticize Mr. Trump within his own party, right, take very different positions than Mr. Trump does on climate change. So John Kasich, former governor of Ohio, a state with plenty of coal, by the way, has acknowledged that climate change is real and the country needs to do something about it. Larry Hogan, governor of Maryland, has pretty strong environmental record. He said we need to do something about climate change. William Weld, former governor of Massachusetts, has said much the same. So, I guess exactly what it is that Mr. Trump should do is unclear to me. I think, he is seeing resistance in certain corners of his party. I don't know that those corners, those individuals I've reflected, represent a large section of the Republican kind of grassroots. That's not clear to me. In some sense, as a matter of policy, I think you should do a number of things different, right? Particularly on the issues of climate. As a matter of politics, it's not clear to me. One of the things I do worry about is polarization in the country, right? Americans increasingly at odds with each other, higher levels of animosity, lower levels of amity, right? And so from a kind of civic standpoint, I would argue it'd be nice if he tried to reach out and lower the temperature, so to speak, of his rhetoric so as to avoid defection from people who would otherwise vote for him. Hmm. But it's not clear to me that that's what he's interested in doing.
Right. Well, on that note of uncertainty, we draw to a close this conversation, which I appreciate its sort of length and breadth and depth, and we have a lot to watch with great interest over the next few months, and I trust that you'll be willing to come back as as things continue to heat up in more ways than one. And I appreciate the expertise and with which you've addressed so many questions that we talked about today. Appreciate that very much.
Well, it's incumbent on all of us to try to make sense of this. I'm no different than anybody else in that regard, trying to make sense of this. And then communicate what we think we know.
Absolutely. Dr. Gerald Mass, Associate Professor of Political Science at Carthage, thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you, Greg.
Monday on the morning show, I look forward to a conversation with Cameron Swallow. She is part of an organization called Better Angels, which seeks to help to bring together people from two different political aisles, so to speak, and make it more possible for people to more effectively communicate with one another and understand the perspectives of the other. And so we will talk with Cameron.